I'm reading from UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald R. Smith. Now, Sidney Sheldon, as I've said each night I've been on this subject, is a novelist whose most recent bestseller, The Doomsday Conspiracy, is built around a plot that involves a so-called UFO crash in Switzerland. Sidney Sheldon puts an author's note at the end of his novel, The Doomsday Conspiracy, which he traces what it's obvious has had an impact on him. The evidence is four UFOs and a conspiracy to cover it up. And since we're all over New Mexico on Channel 2, covering, waiting all these years to have somebody that right on the scene can confirm some of this stuff. I don't know whether it's true or not. I'm a little more sure of this than I am Professor Hill's story, though. Do I have to review, or can I just pick up where I left off? Should have been listening last night. Go to bed. It's early. I mean, might as well stay up tonight, too. Nothing on TV in the morning except Thomas and Hill. After the civilians were gone, that's from the crash site, the military brought in trucks and a few dozen men to clean the site. The bodies were loaded into the back of one of the trucks, in which there were several large blocks of ice. About dusk, I remember one of the little things I told you about was the sheriff that found the first crash site, not the sheriff, but the farmer, Razel. In his interview with Frank Joyce, even though he was escorted and sort of clamped down on by the military, as he was leaving with his canned, approved story that was somewhat different than the first story he told. And while we're worrying about this 9-year-old sex charge, I said last night, half the nation doesn't even know about it. 14 CFR 1211, where if you have been extraterrestrially exposed, the administrator of NASA can quarantine you, apprehend and seize such person, property, animal, or other form of life or matter, whatever, keep you, and if a judge gives a court order to release you, Section 1211-107 orders you not to obey the court order, but to show up in court and say you cannot comply because of this section of the federal code. And then 1211-108 would make the judge, given the order, violating the code. And the quarantine is done on the subjective opinion of the administrator, without any probable cause, trying to find that phrase, without any probable cause, with or without a hearing, at the administrator's discretion. And how many of you last night didn't know this law existed? A lot of things that violate our rights going on. The media can't get excited about real things. They want to hear somebody talk about a 9-year-old discussion of gonads. After the civilians were gone, the military brought in trucks and a few dozen men to clean the site. The bodies were loaded into the back of one of the trucks, in which there were several large blocks of ice. And I said, concerning these bodies, and the farmer who found the site first, as he ended his discussion with Frank Joyce, the radio personality, he said, "Frank," Brazel turned to him and said, as he was walking out the door, "Frank, you know how they talk of little green men? They weren't green." Now, after the civilians were gone, the military brought in trucks and a few dozen men to clean the site. The bodies were loaded into the back of one of the trucks, in which there were several large blocks of ice. About dusk, Sergeant Melvin E. Brown and one other soldier were stationed in the truck with orders not to look under the tarp. Hell, anybody knows that's like God saying, "Don't eat the tree." You know that tarp's going to get lifted. Brown could not resist the temptation, and as soon as his superiors moved away, he pulled the tarp aside. There, he saw bodies. Like Barnett, Brown described them as smaller than human. He said the skin was yellowish-orange, that might have been an effect of the lighting or decomposition. He said that the skin was similar to that of a lizard, meaning it was leathery and beaded, but not scaly. But Brown was not the only one to report bodies at the crash site. Captain Darwin E. Rasmussen, the 718th Bomb Group Operations Officer, part of the 509th, told family members that four bodies had been recovered at Roswell. Rasmussen, or Elaine V., V-E-G-H, some of you in New Mexico may know the family and tell me how to pronounce the name. Until I hear it's going to be V. Elaine V., Rasmussen's cousin, reported she had heard Rasmussen tell her father that he had no doubt that flying saucers were real because he had helped to retrieve the bodies from the one that crashed. As soon as the bodies were loaded into the truck, they were driven from the crash site to the Roswell Army Airfield, where they were taken to the base hospital. Brown and the other soldier remained in the truck during the trip. Once there, Brown was dismissed and the bodies were taken inside the building. Shortly after the bodies arrived at the base, a mortician from Roswell, Glenn Dennis, also arrived. I've been waiting years to be on in New Mexico so I could say, "Hey, New Mexicans, these people full of it, or you know anything about this?" It's a lot more important to me to sort out than whether Professor Hill is lying. I figured that out early on. This is kind of tough to figure out. Shortly after the bodies arrived at the base, a mortician from Roswell, Glenn Dennis, also arrived. All afternoon, the doctors at the base had been calling the mortuary, asking questions about preservation techniques. "What's this going to do to the blood system? What's this going to do to the tissue?" The mortician was told by the military doctors that the bodies had been out on the prairie for a couple of days, maybe a week. The mortician stressed that the military doctors at the base hospital called him repeatedly, asking different questions each time. He described some of the embalming techniques, but was told that wasn't what they wanted to know. They were more interested in the best way to move the dead. The implication then, according to him, was that the dead were humans killed in a plane crash. According to the mortician, he was told there were three fatalities. Two of them had been mangled in the crash, but the other was in fairly good shape. The officers at the base wanted to know if they could get all three into a single, hermetically sealed casket. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Records available for the time, however, show that no personnel at the Roswell Army Airfield died. The unit history for July 1947 states there were no deaths recorded at the hospital. But the mortician was told that there were casualties. The mortician, assuming there had been a plane crash, climbed into the hearse and drove out to the base. He was waved through the gate because he had been out there often on official business and was easily recognized. At the hospital, he parked next to one of the old box-type military ambulances on the back ramp. He got out of the hearse and walked up the ramp. At the top were two MPs staring down into an ambulance that had its rear doors open. Inside, he could see some metallic wreckage that he didn't recognize. It didn't look like the material normally found at an airplane crash site. Inside the hospital, he was met by another MP who demanded to know what he was doing there. The mortician told the MP who he was, and the MP let him pass, apparently believing that someone at the base had summoned him. As the mortician walked down a corridor, he was seen by one of the base hospital nurses. She wanted to know how he had gotten into the hospital and told him to get the hell out. She said, "My God, you're going to get yourself killed." Dennis could not understand her sudden fright and told her that the MPs had not stopped him. She was still agitated and told him to get out. Before he could respond, two MPs grabbed him by the arms, lifted him from his feet, and carried him outside. He was escorted off the base and followed to his parents' home. The next day, the nurse explained what had happened in the hospital. Bodies had arrived, just as Dennis had suspected, but the bodies were not human. She didn't know what they were or where they came from. She said they were little, smaller than an adult human. She said the hands were different, too, that they had only four fingers with the middle two protruding longer than the others. She saw no opposable thumb. She also said that the anatomy of the arm was different. The bone from the shoulder to the elbow was shorter than the bone from the elbow to the wrist. The heads were larger than a human's. The eyes were large and had a concave shape. She said that all the features, the nose and the ears and the eyes, were slightly concave. The nurse added that the bodies were very delicate. The skulls and the bones were very fragile. She said that it reminded her of pictures of the mummies she had seen, thin, spindly, and fragile. She said that the bodies had been exposed to the elements and to predators for several days. There was no indication of any sex organs. Candidate for the Supreme Court. Always away. But she didn't think that was strange given the circumstances. Unperturbed nurse, I'd say. She mentioned that it looked as if predators had attacked the bodies and the soft tissues of the genitals were normally the first areas destroyed. She also said that the bodies were frozen once they arrived in Roswell. They were sealed in rubberized mortuary bags and nailed in a crate for shipment, possibly because of the stench they gave off. She said that she heard the final destination was Wright Field, and she was sure they were sent there eventually, but once they left the hospital, she lost track of them. Pappy Henderson, a captain with the 1st Air Transport Unit assigned to Roswell, we talked about him last night, also saw the bodies. Given the scenario, there is only one point where Henderson could have seen them, and that is on the crash site. Henderson, as a pilot, would have had no reason to be on the site, but as one of Blanchard's most trusted officers, it stands to reason that Henderson would have been called in by Blanchard to fly one of the reconnaissance planes. It seems likely that Henderson saw the bodies as he flew over an aircraft and possibly directed the ground parties to the second site. Henderson told a close personal friend and fellow military officer, Dr. John Kromschoder, about the bodies in early 1978. According to Kromschoder, Henderson and he were sharing stories while on a fishing trip. And after several hours, Henderson mentioned that he had seen the bodies of alien visitors and the remains of their craft. Kromschoder said that Henderson was clearly nervous about it. Henderson, according to the source, didn't like being around the dead or injured and wanted to get away from them as quickly as he could. The source quoted Henderson as saying, "I really couldn't look at them." But he did see enough to say that they were kind of little guys. Henderson said they'd been put into the deep freeze and that as late as 1986, Henderson thought they were still at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Naturally, Kromschroeder wanted to talk more about it, but Henderson would only repeat the descriptions and then said, "I just can't talk about it." You want any more?
Yes, sir.
Kromschroeder, having been a good friend of Henderson's for years, believed the story. He said that Henderson was clearly uncomfortable talking about it. Henderson said that he had never even told his wife, Sappho, because of the top secret classification of the information. Henderson talked only because his friend was another military man who understood the significance of the information and the restrictions of military classification. Kromschroeder would have believed Henderson even if he had had no proof of what he said, but about a year later in 1979, Henderson showed Kromschroeder a small piece of metal that Henderson said was from the craft. Kromschroeder had studied metals for years and had never seen anything like it. The metal, according to the doctor, was gray and resembled aluminum, but was harder and stiffer. He couldn't bend it, but had to be careful because the edges were sharp. He said that it didn't seem to have a crystalline structure and based that on the fracturing of it. It hadn't been torn. Kromschroeder said that Henderson claimed the metal was some of the lighter material lining of the craft. He said that when properly energized, it produced perfect illumination. It was a soft light with no shadows. Henderson, after seeing an article about the Roswell event in 1982, mentioned the bodies to his daughter, Mary Catherine Grude. He told her a little more about them, saying that they were little men, gray, with slanted eyes and tiny mouths. He didn't tell his daughter how he happened to see the bodies, only that he had. Henderson hinted that the bodies were at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The nurse thought it was the final destination for them. Neither Henderson nor the nurse knew what happened to the bodies or the crate once it left the hospital. Others, however, did have that information. According to Frank Kaufman, the bodies were sealed in a wooden crate while still at the hospital. Under the cover of darkness, the crate was loaded into a covered truck and driven to a hangar on the flight line. Once there, it was unloaded and carried inside. Kaufman said that MPs were stationed around the interior of the hangar and that a searchlight was set to shine on the crate. It remained there overnight. Brown, who had ridden with the bodies from the crash site, was added to the guard detail outside the hangar. While he was standing guard, the commanding officer of Squadron K of the 509th Bomb Group, Captain John Martin, walked up and said, "Come on, Brownie, let's have a look inside." There was nothing to see except the wooden crate. Brown said that it all had been packed up for shipment to Fort Worth. Martin and Brown walked back outside. Years later, on the days when Americans first landed on the moon, Brown told his family the story of the crash at Roswell. They were reluctant to believe him, but each of them remembered that Brown told them to tell no one else because Daddy will get into trouble. In 1986, as Brown was on his deathbed, his daughter, Beverly Bean, said that Brown talked about Roswell extensively. He mentioned over and over that, quote, it was not a damn weather balloon. Brown's wife still will not talk about it, nor will his oldest daughter. Both are afraid that it will reflect poorly on Brown's military record and that the Army could retaliate. They qualify under this law. For example, if a person or a thing, A, touches B, and C touches B, A through C would be extraterrestrially exposed, and A and B directly and C indirectly. And the law still applies to them. You better keep your mouth shut. Or get it. Beverly Bean, however, wanted everyone to know what her father had told her on his deathbed. He had seen the bodies. He had... You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
No, you get on the telephone. Albuquerque. Frank Joyce is still on Channel 7, does an outdoor report in the summer out here. I've been here for 26 years and never heard about this. Thank you for letting us know. Isn't that interesting? UFO crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald Schmidt. Beverly Bean wanted everyone to know what her father had told her on his deathbed. He had seen the bodies. He had escorted them into Roswell, and he knew that it was not a weather balloon. The crate containing the bodies remained in the hangar overnight. About noon the next day, July 9th, it was loaded into another truck and driven out to bomb pit number one on a remote part of the airbase. The bodies remained there for another 2 or 3 hours. Then, according to a witness who requested anonymity because he was afraid he could lose his job, the crate was loaded onto a B-29 to be flown to Fort Worth. According to him, the flight crew, including Second Lieutenant Joe C. Shackelford, Second Lieutenant Elmer L. Landry, CPL Thaddeus Love, Staff Sergeant Robert A. Slusher and PFC Jesse M. DeLozier were on the skeet range after lunch. All of them had heard the rumors that a flying disc with bodies had been found on a ranch near Roswell. Although Walter Hout's press release had already been printed in the local newspaper, Ramey's explanation wouldn't be published for another few hours. They left the skeet range and returned to the squadron area. Most of the other flight crews had already been sent home for the day. But the squadron operations officer, Edgar Skelly, told the aircraft commander to keep his crew together because there might be a special flight. Once it was decided to ship the bodies, the flight crew went out to pre-flight the aircraft, a B-29, but didn't have the usual time allotment for the task. They were forced to rush through it. About an hour later, they were ordered to taxi to the pit where the bombs were normally kept. This time, the pit was covered with a canvas tarp. When the tarp was removed, they saw a large wooden crate sitting on a platform used to carry cargo. It was loaded into the bomb bay along with an armed escort of 6 military police, an officer, 2 sergeants, and 3 enlisted men. All were armed with 45s, and one of the enlisted men had an M1 carbine. Normally, they didn't fly with carbines because the weapons could become entangled in the control cables. They never allowed the crate out of their sight. Before takeoff, the officer crew members reported to base operations for their flight briefings and clearances. When they returned, only the bombardier was allowed to look into the bomb bay to make sure the load was properly secured. The flight engineer and the crew chief weren't concerned about the weight because they had been told the load did not weigh more than 5,000 pounds, and therefore no ballast in the tail was required. Everything about the flight was unusual, said the source. So tight was security that we knew the crate contained more than the general's furniture. He described the crate as made of wood, unpainted and unmarked. It was about 5 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 15 feet long. Same as Pappy Henderson's description. Certainly large enough to contain the three or four bodies recovered at the crash site. The witnesses said that the afternoon was hot and muggy and that they were looking forward to getting airborne. The flight was ordered to stay at 8,000 feet rather than the routine 25 or 30,000. The escort and the crate remained in the bomb bay. According to Kurt Platt, a member of the 509th Bomb Group, transporting cargo and passengers in the bomb bay wasn't unusual. He said there were rails or racks that fit into the bomb bay so that both cargo and passengers could be transported. Because the bomb bay was not pressurized, they had to stay below 10,000 feet. According to Platt, they frequently carried people and cargo in that manner. The plane flew directly to the Fort Worth Army Airfield. There, they were met by a contingent of officers from Fort Worth, including a man that the bombardier recognized as a mortician. According to the bombardier, he had gone to school with the man and knew that he had become a mortician. Once the crate was unloaded, the crew was ordered to return to Roswell immediately. No time was spent in Fort Worth. They just turned the aircraft around and took off. The bombardier told the crew that they were all now, quote, part of history because of the cargo they had carried. After seeing a copy of the 509th yearbook, the witness said that he believed that Jesse Marcel had been on the return flight. And you know him from the original investigation of the site. He said he was sure there had been an intelligence officer on the return flight. Robert Slusher, who was also on the flight, confirmed the view. Later, Jesse Marcel Jr. said he remembered that his father had been gone for more than 24 hours. In other words, Marcel took a flight to Fort Worth on July 8th with some of the wreckage and returned on July 9th with the B-29 that had brought the bodies. The source, who still has his flight log books, confirmed the July 9th date. He had flown in a B-29, tail number 7301, on a cross-country flight from Roswell to Fort Worth and back again. Total flight time was 1 hour and 55 minutes, including the short period they were on the ground in Fort Worth. According to all the stories, once the bodies were discovered, they stayed in New Mexico only a few hours. Through witnesses, they have been traced from the crash site near Corona, New Mexico, to Roswell and then on to Fort Worth. The base nurse said that their final destination was Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. At that point, they seemed to disappear. If there were bodies in the crate loaded onto the B-29 at Roswell, once they arrived at the Fort Worth Army Airfield, they disappear. A chain of witnesses taking them from the crash site to Roswell and then to Fort Worth had been found. But once the bodies arrived in Fort Worth, the chain was broken. The assumption was that the bodies, like some of the wreckage, would have gone on to Wright Field, but there is no concrete evidence of that. Over the years, stories were told about alien bodies at Wright Field, and it was believed they were the bodies recovered outside Roswell. Lynn Stringfield, in his research, had located a number of witnesses to the presence of bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. One of the people whose report found its way to Lynn Stringfield was from a woman named Norma Gardner, a one-time employee at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. In 1959, she retired for health reasons. She hinted to friends that she knew more about the flying saucer situation than the government was comfortable with her knowing. Given a top security clearance, she had been given the chore of logging in all UFO-related material, logging it in, which included parts of the interior of a craft that had been brought to the base in the past. Everything had been photographed and tagged and labeled, and all the documents had to be filed with someone. Norma Gardner had that task. At one point, she saw two bodies as they were moved from one location to another. The bodies had been preserved in some kind of chemical solution. She said that they were small, 4 or 5 feet tall, with large heads and slanted eyes, and obviously were not human. In the course of her duties, she also typed the autopsy reports on them. Gardner is important for one other reason. She was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. She was one of the first sources to confirm that corpses had been brought to the base. It didn't prove the bodies were from Roswell, but it provided a starting point for investigators. Gardner, however, is not the lone source about the bodies and their location. Sidney Sheldon, The Doomsday Conspiracy, as I already told you, he and I served together on the Blue Ribbon Committee for the Library here in Los Angeles, and this new best-selling novel that I've referenced is bringing UFOs to the front again, fictionally based on a UFO crash with bodies in it, covered up in a conspiracy in Switzerland. But he has an author's note at the end about his research, and he publishes a letter by L. Gordon Cooper, Colonel U.S. Air Force, retired astronaut, to Ambassador Griffith, Mission of Grenada to the United Nations, address New York, New York. Dear Ambassador Griffith, I wanted to convey my views on our extraterrestrial visitors, popularly referred to as UFOs, and suggest what might be done to properly deal with them. I believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets. Which obviously are a little more technically advanced than we are here on Earth. Skipping down, he says, I did have occasion in 1951 to have 2 days of observation of many flights of them, of different sizes, flying in fighter formation generally from east to west over Europe. They were at a higher altitude than we could reach with our jet fighters at the time. I would also like to point out that most astronauts are very reluctant to even discuss UFOs due to the great numbers of people who have indiscriminately sold fake stories and forged documents. There are several of us who do believe in UFOs and who have had occasions to see a UFO on the ground or from an airplane. Gardner, however, is not the lone source about the bodies and their location. Oh, you don't want me to continue. At least I'm not convinced until you get on the telephone.